Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Rita Peters here in the studio with my co-host Dean Welty and a very special guest, whom I will introduce in just a moment. If you've been listening to our program for a while, you've heard me talk a lot about Article 5 of the Constitution and the Convention of States Project. My day job is all about Article 5. And as a reminder, Article 5 is the part of the Constitution that governs the process of amending the Constitution. There are two ways to do this under Article 5. The first way is that Congress can propose an amendment if two-thirds of each chamber are supportive of it. And the second way is that the states can propose amendments in a meeting that's called a convention whenever two-thirds of the state legislatures apply for a convention to propose amendments on a certain subject. Now, either way the proposals happen, amendments always have to be ratified by three-fourths of the states in order to be effective. But it's the second process, the Convention of States, that we're talking about today. It's never been used before, even though it was provided by the founders as a means for the states to check the power of the federal government. So Convention of States Action, the organization that I work with, is working toward a convention to propose amendments on three topics: imposing fiscal restraints on the federal government, limiting the power and jurisdiction of the federal government, and setting term limits for federal officials. So that's what we're here to talk about today, Dean, with our guest, whom we're not quite ready to introduce yet, right?
Right. Before we introduce our guest, Rita, and dive into our topic, I'd like to give our audience a little background on the Convention of States organization itself. And I'll be reading from the website. Quote, "The Convention of States Project is first and foremost a movement of grassroots citizens who are fed up with the business as usual in Washington. We're funded by thousands of everyday patriots who have committed their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to protecting liberty for future generations. The organization was founded in 2014, which, by the way, was in the middle of Obama's second term, by its current president, Mark Meckler, and Michael Ferris, who is now the president of Alliance Defending Freedom. I should also mention, Rita, that the Convention of States Project is endorsed by such notable individuals as Mark Levin, Ben Shapiro, Senator Rand Paul, Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, Dr. James Dobson, Sean Hannity, Senator Jim DeMint, and David Barton. And that is a hall of heroes.
Absolutely.
With that kind of endorsement.
Well, our guest today is someone whose name may not be quite as recognizable to most of our listeners, but he is an academic all-star, an academic heavyweight. He is a constitutional lawyer, scholar, and historian. He was a law professor for 25 years, serving at three different universities, and he has written books and articles on a wide variety of constitutional topics, including my personal favorite, The Law of Article 5. His research has been cited repeatedly by the U.S. Supreme Court, federal appeals courts, and state Supreme Courts. He also writes a regular column for the Epoch Times, which is phenomenal. It is my pleasure to work with him frequently in his capacity now as senior advisor to the Convention of States Project. Our guest is Rob Nadelson. Rob, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you, Rita and Dean.
Well, Rob, I just want to echo what Rita just said. Thank you so much for being with us today. I feel like I know you pretty well, as often as Rita talks about you. So when you said the great one, I wasn't sure if you were referring to her or to yourself. But anyway.
I was referring to her, of course.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Why don't you, Rob, just kick things off by telling us a little bit more about your personal background and how you got interested in this whole topic of Article 5?
Well, I practiced law for about 10 years, 11 years, actually, in two different states, and then became an academic. I was a law professor for 25 years, which I think you mentioned in your introduction. And since 2010, I've been back in the private sector doing constitutional consulting. About 1999, 2000, I started a project because I had always had an interest in the founding era and had some background in it. I started a project whereby I tried to elucidate in my scholarly articles parts of the Constitution that had either not been written much about, were not really widely understood, or had been written about, but the writing wasn't very good. And believe it or not, there's a lot of that. You know, a lot of people were incredulous at the idea that after 130 years, there would still be parts of the Constitution that we moderns don't fully understand. But it's true. And I wrote on the Commerce Clause. I wrote on the First Amendment, including the religion clauses in particular. I wrote on the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which you probably have never heard of, a number of other things like the Guarantee Clause you probably never heard of. But one day this was in 2009, I was going through the Constitution looking for another candidate to investigate, and I found these words, Convention for Proposing Amendments. And I said, well, I think I know what that is, but I haven't really seen much on it. There hasn't been much written about it, at least not of any quality, and I'd like to investigate it. And so from that investigation, I learned, first off, that what I thought I had known about this process was wrong, and that what most other people were saying about it was also wrong. And I discovered that it was a usable process. I discovered the rules by which conventions were supposed to be held. And I said to myself, gee, you know, I think this should be used for the reasons that the founders put it in the Constitution for, and that is to be an important check and balance. And so from that time, I've been very involved in advising organizations that seek to use Article 5, seek to use a convention procedure for amending the Constitution. And because this is a procedure that belongs to everybody, not just to me or to Convention of States action, I've advised other organizations as well. One other thing, I'll wrap up this rather lengthy explanation with saying that unlike most of the people you hear discussing issues like this, I wasn't paid for my conclusions. You know, I didn't go into it with the idea of coming to a particular conclusion. The only compensation I received was my academic salary. And so the conclusions I reached were as a result of honest research. And I hope people take that into account when they hear what I have to say about the convention process.
Well, Rob, you mentioned that in the course of your research, you found out that a lot of what had been written before about the Article 5 convention process turned out to be wrong. Can you expound on that a little bit more and tell us about anything else you found that surprised you as you did your research?
Well, there were a number of things that were widely believed. I don't think they're believed anymore among people who actually have researched in this area, but at the time they were. One was that an Article 5 convention was a constitutional convention that could potentially rewrite the Constitution. We know now that that's not true. Another thing that was widely believed was that the delegates, and we now know the proper term is actually commissioners, the delegates to the convention would be popularly selected so that states like New York and California would have disproportionate representation. We know that's not true. But it was also widely claimed at the time that there was no real potential for controlling the convention. I actually thought that might be true, but now realize it isn't. And then finally, it was often claimed that the convention could actually changed the ratification process so that they could bypass the states in ratifying it. Now, I never believed that because it conflicts with the words of the Constitution, and that theory, which is still expounded in a few quarters, is obviously cockamamie, so that I never believed that. But my investigation certainly confirmed that that wasn't true either. As to other things that surprised me, I think the biggest thing that surprised me is that the Convention of States has been used before, not to propose amendments under Article 5, but to propose amendments. And it's been used for many other purposes. Conventions of states, actually conventions of colonies, date back to 1677. So we know their procedure rather well. Also, I discovered that there had been a U.S. Supreme Court decision that helped to clarify what a convention for proposing amendments is, and that there was an enormous amount of founding era material and an enormous amount of material subsequent to the founding era that explained this procedure. So it wasn't just that I learned that the procedure was something I didn't know it was, but that there was just an overwhelming amount of evidence on this subject that the big mouths who were talking about this procedure had no knowledge of.
Well, Rob, that's an interesting background, and it really raises a question. In my mind, it seems like the convention is almost a relic of the past to some people. So it has a great history, and yet today it seems to be pushed over to the side as inconsequential, immaterial. So why do you think it's important today for people to know and understand this history and the law of Article 5? Anything particular today stand out for you?
Well, one thing that the founders emphasized is that we had to frequently recur to first principles. What they meant by that is that we also always had to remind ourselves of what the principles were, of what the foundations were of our free republic. And if we didn't do that, we would lose that. And so that's part of what I'm involved in is constitutional education. The vast majority of people who kind of push the Constitution aside know very little about it. I'm currently working on a series in the Epoch Times called Defending the Constitution, in which I'm correcting some of the gross errors out there, not just about Article 5, but about the Constitution generally that are commonly believed. Why are they commonly believed? Well, I'll give you one hint. About 2008, actually it was earlier than that, when my middle daughter, I have three daughters, when the middle one was in high school, I asked to take a look at her social studies book. She was, I think, a junior or a senior at the time. And I went to the passage in which the Constitution was discussed. And I found that in three pages or so of discussion on the Constitution, there were so many errors that correcting them actually required that I write a four-page, single-spaced memorandum to correct them all. There's just gross misunderstanding of the Constitution. And then there are a certain number of people, Dean, who just don't give a darn. I mean, people who just want absolute power and the Constitution is just an obstruction to be waved aside. I don't think most Americans believe that. However, one of the reasons why the Convention for Proposing Amendments was put into the Constitution was to make sure that people like that never got the upper hand. Or if they did, that their arrogance was corrected. And let me give you a fairly recent example. Every president, beginning with George Washington, established a tradition that they would retire after two terms. They could run for office, win the first term, they could run for a second term, but after that, they would step down. In 1940, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was one of the most powerful presidents that we've ever had, decided that he wanted a third term. And there was some justification for that. I mean, we were careening toward World War II. The country had some real problems. He was certainly able to rationalize that to himself. He ran and he won a third term, and then he ran and he won a fourth term. After he died, Americans decided they didn't want to see that again. They wanted to enshrine in the Constitution George Washington's rule that there should only be two terms for the president. Well, Americans looked to Congress to propose such an amendment, and it didn't happen. So what did happen is a number of different states started passing resolutions called applications in order to force a convention for proposing a two-term amendment. Minnesota passed such an application, Michigan, Montana, several others. And urged by those states in that way, Congress finally got around to proposing such an amendment. Then the states ratified it, although that required a little pushing too. And so the result was the 22nd Amendment, which provides that no president can serve more than two terms. That's a provision of the Constitution which has been respected ever since. It was adopted in 1952. And I think overwhelmingly Americans would agree it was a good idea. Mm-hmm. And so that's why the Convention of States movement wants to extend that term limit rule to other federal officials, to members of Congress, to the courts, perhaps to other officials in the executive branch. It was an experiment that really worked out, and it was one that reaffirmed founding era principles in the modern era.
I got involved initially with the Convention of States project because once I learned about it, I came to believe that it is the logical legal solution to the problems in our government today, namely federal overreach and abuse of power. But we know that Congress is not going to propose amendments that will limit its own power. So that kind of amendment is only going to be proposed through a convention of the states. But Rob, you know, it seems like so many people have this really strong negative emotional reaction to the whole idea of an Article 5 convention. Why do you think that is?
Well, let me answer that by just confirming something that you said. Congress is not going to propose limits on its own power. Mm-hmm. That statement is strongly supported by the historical record. In fact, if you go back and look at all of the amendments, at all of the efforts for amendments, Congress, with the arguable exception of the repeal of prohibition, has never proposed limits on its own power since it proposed the Bill of Rights in 1789. And by the way, it proposed the Bill of Rights in part because the Commonwealth of Virginia and the state of New York threatened to force a convention unless a Bill of Rights was called. Mm-hmm. So I hear this all the time. Oh, you know, we'll elect good people to Congress. It doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. We've got 230 years of experience to prove it doesn't happen. Now, as to why people are averse to it, partly it's just lack of knowledge about the process, but partly, and Rita, there's no polite way to put this, they've been propagandized. Mm-hmm. In the 20th century, very powerful forces, and I'm not going to be mysterious about this, I'll name names, very powerful forces who were apologists for the establishment inserted into the mainstream media and into the academic literature and into public discourse false ideas about a convention for proposing amendments, some of which I've already mentioned, mm-hmm. you know, that it's a constitutional convention, that it's not controllable, that it could be controlled by a few big states, that it could change the ratification process, even that it could be controlled by Congress. Mm-hmm. All of those statements are demonstrably false. But nevertheless, they were inserted into the public discourse. Well, who did it? There was some rustling in that direction early in the 20th century, but really it was put into the mainstream, starting with a guy named Charles Black, who was a professor at Yale Law School, who wrote two articles, one in the 60s and one in the 70s, which he placed in the Yale Law Journal. If you go to the Article 5 Information Center, which is the website that I moderate, you'll get links to those articles. They're freely available. He wrote articles in which he made up a lot of the stuff about an Article 5 convention. Mm-hmm. He was then followed by other liberal academics, a man named George Swindler from Georgetown Law School, who managed to convince former Chief Justice Warren Berger that a convention was a bad idea. Larry Tribe of Harvard Law School, who's still around, wrote an article repeating a bunch of talking points or questions. Unfortunately, while Larry Tribe is deservedly a respected constitutional scholar in other areas, he had not done his homework on Article 5. Mm-hmm. The New York Times and the Washington Post picked up these stories about the Article 5 convention. Again, if you go to the Article 5 information website, you'll see a study which actually links you to articles in the Washington Post and the New York Times repeating these talking points. A group of people around the Kennedy clan, like Theodore Sorensen, their speechwriter, or Arthur Goldberg, John Kennedy's Secretary of Labor, they repeated these same talking points. And so this got into the public discourse, and it was designed to scare people away from an Article 5 convention because the people who were doing the scaring didn't want to limit Congress's power. They were tied in well with Congress.
Yeah.
Many years later, certain right-wing groups, really unaware of the reasons for this propaganda, picked it up themselves, I think for fundraising purposes, and started to spread it. But, you know, very often when a myth gets started, a propaganda gets started, it's very difficult to counteract it. I will say that in the 11 or 12 years since I've begun working in this area, however, we have come a long way in correcting that propaganda.
Again, interesting background. And just to confirm what you've just said, one of our former members of the House of Delegates here in Virginia put in other words what you just said, which is Congress is not going to limit its own authority because, he said, there's no such thing as a self-butchering hog. I think that just paints the picture very clearly. But in addition to this concern about a runaway convention, another objection people raise is that the federal government isn't following the Constitution anyway. That's the problem. So how will amending the Constitution fix that problem?
Okay, well, I'll answer that. But first, we've never really addressed why a runaway convention is impossible. It's literally impossible. And the answer is that the convention commissioners are under the control of the state legislatures who send them. They're the same state legislatures, pretty much, who chose the topic that the convention gets to consider. And today, there are additional reasons, and that is that we've got technology that enables us to watch the convention 24/7, and that means that any convention commissioner who gets out of line can be called home or instructed to stay on the agenda. In addition, anything that the convention comes out with, which is outside of its power, can simply be struck down by the courts or ignored by Congress when Congress chooses a method of ratifying the amendment. So it is literally, the whole runaway story is literally impossible. Now, as to the argument that, well, gee, we don't follow the Constitution anyway, what makes you think you follow amendments? The people who make that argument have never investigated history. Because if they had investigated history, they would find that while portions of the original Constitution are disregarded, the amendments are not disregarded. Ask yourself, where would we be today without the First Amendment? Has the First Amendment been disregarded? The answer is no. Well, the First Amendment's been interpreted a little differently than the founders intended, but it's still a powerful protection for free speech and freedom of religion, and it's applied by the courts every day.
Yeah.
Even though it was adopted 230 some odd years ago. And so let's look more recently. Is the amendment that ensured that women have the right to vote, is that disregarded? Well, of course not. Is the amendment that abolishes slavery disregarded? Is the amendment that limits the president to two terms disregarded? You know, if you go through all of these amendments, and there be 27 of them, there's only one that you can argue doesn't really have much in the way of teeth today, and that is the Ninth Amendment. Even the Tenth Amendment, which reserves powers to the states and the people, doesn't have its full original force, but is still applied by the court and is still used to limit federal authority. So the statement that amendments don't make any difference is a statement made by people who are either misrepresenting or they just don't know what they're talking about. I rather think it's the second. I think most of the people who make that statement just have never done the investigation. They don't know anything about history. They pretend to know stuff about the Constitution, but they don't. And they don't know anything about law. So what more can I say about it?
We know that at a convention for proposing amendments, the convention can't just go off and propose anything it wants. It is limited to proposing amendments on the subjects identified by the state legislatures that apply for the convention and frame the agenda. So the Convention of States Project, the organization that I'm working for, is for a convention of the states to propose amendments on three topics: fiscal restraints on the federal government, limiting the power and jurisdiction of the federal government, and setting term limits for federal officials. Rob, do you believe that the situation in America could really be improved by amendments on one or more of those topics? And we just have a couple more minutes, but I'd like to get your comment on that.
Sure. I should mention that there have been about 40 conventions of states and colonies. The most recent convention of states was in 2017. They all stayed on topic, including the Constitutional Convention, which some people ignorantly think didn't stay on topic. Mm-hmm. And yes, I think those amendments could help greatly. They're not a panacea, okay? No constitutional amendment is going to cure everything, mm-hmm. but they can do enormous good. For example, I think a term limits amendment, term limits are approved by something like 85% of the population right now. Mm-hmm. We have people sitting in Congress for up to 50 years, mm-hmm. Generations of people living, and then they hand over the job to their kids sometimes. I mean, that breeds certain arrogance that would not exist if members of Congress were limited to 12 or even 18 years.
Right.
Also the courts. When the Supreme Court was established, you know, generally people died at about age 60. Men appointed to the court would serve for about 8 years and maybe die on an average of about 60 years old. Today they sit on the court for 20, 30 years or more. And that creates a certain mindset which is different from the mindset of the rest of us. So that's just term limits. If we established a provision that said that the federal government could only raise the debt limit if 3/5 of the states agreed, well, then maybe we'd get a lot more thoughtful budgeting and less profligate spending, and we wouldn't be passing all this down to our kids and grandkids and creating inflation today. So, yeah, these particular topics could do enormous good.
Well, Rob, we are about out of time. We could talk to you for a long time, but we only have 30 minutes for this program. So we're going to wrap up and hope to have you back on an upcoming program. Thank you for being with us today. And I want to tell our listeners to learn more and to join the movement. Visit conventionofstates.com. That's it for us today. So thanks again to our special guest, Rob Nadelson, distinguished author, professor, constitutional scholar, and senior advisor to the Convention of States Project. We also want to thank our generous sponsors at Blue Ridge Chimney Services, Blessings Christian Bookstore, Sunshine Ministries with Christian Radio, Wishing Well Florists and Travel Services, and our good friends at New Beginnings Church and Garber's Church of the Brethren in Harrisonburg. Thank you all for listening and also for your encouragement and financial support. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to help keep Crossroads on the air, you can do so by check to Crossroads at P.O. Box 881, Harrisonburg, 22803. If you would like to listen to this program again or share it with your friends, go to valleyfamilyforum.org and click on the link to Crossroads on the homepage. I'm Rita Peters with Dean Welty and engineer Robbie Meadows, inviting you to join us again next week for another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. Let us rejoice.